know, they say the report's not about Pebble. Even in the executive summary, we're mentioned 25 times.
Groups gear up to debate the EPA's Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a reality of life in rural Alaska, spending the last month of pregnancy far from home.
You know, you don't want to be bored and idle here because homesick that far away from home for that long is pretty tough.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
The EPA is holding a public comment hearing on its draft assessment of the Bristol Bay watershed until 9 o'clock tonight in Anchorage. There will be more hearings around the state on the assessment later this week. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, advocates for and against the proposed Pebble Mine are reacting to the assessment with differing and predictable points of view.
The draft assessment is just that, a draft. It does not have legal authority and does not rule in any direction. But some opponents of the mine see the assessment as potentially good news, including Bella Hammond. She's the wife of former Governor Jay Hammond. She says the salmon fishery in Bristol Bay and the mine cannot coexist.
The fishery is far more important. It's a wonderful source of protein.
And it's more than just food. She's also worried about the mine's potential effects on the long-lived fishing culture in Bristol Bay. The opponents to the mine are not the only ones reading the tea leaves. Industry officials are lashing out at the EPA over the draft assessment.
If they're going to do anything, it would be something that would be aimed right at Pebble. Even though they say the report's not about Pebble, even in the executive summary, we're mentioned 25 times.
John Shively heads the Pebble Partnership, the company aiming to mine Bristol Bay for all sorts of metals, including copper and gold. He says the Pebble Partnership has spent more than $120 million and 8 years studying whether the mine will reap enough profit. But the EPA, he contends, rushed its research, analyzing 20,000 square miles in less than a year. Pebble Partnership has not finished applying for the permits, and the EPA admits it is unusual to release an assessment prior to permitting. To Shively, that looks like an overzealous federal agency regulating state waters, something, he says, the state is in charge of.
If you want to do the watershed assessment, first of all, you ought to do the assessment correctly. And if you're going to do the assessment correctly, it's going to take you several years, so you ought to go back and get that piece right.
You can expect to hear the same arguments from both sides until the final assessment comes out. EPA says that will likely come by the end of the year. In Anchorage, I'm Peter Granitz.
The Air Force plan to relocate the F-16 squadron at Eielson Air Force Base will have serious implications for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District if the move takes place. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
1,024. That's the estimated number of students that the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District stands to lose if a squadron of F-16s are relocated to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. School Superintendent Pete Lewis says that's a big enough loss to force the closure of the three schools at Eielson Air Force Base.
There wouldn't be but, 50 kids left, 100 kids left on the base. It would be difficult for us to continue to provide the quality of programs that we currently offer, so we'd have to look at multiple scenarios in terms of what we might do.
According to the Air Force, the school district could see a $1.5 million reduction in federal funding if the plan moves forward. Lewis says the relocation will change how money is allocated to the district.
Well, I think it will be an adjustment in the foundation formula, that money that comes from the state, and then we also receive impact aid money from the federal government. And that is also formula-driven, and it is a part of how the foundation formula is calculated. So it would be a loss in revenue for us.
The school board has amended their agenda for a work session tonight. They'll discuss the 2012-2013 school year budget. There's no word on whether the school board will start to look at the effects of the Air Force's plan as well. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
After more than 100 years in the Smithsonian Museum collection, the remains of two people from St. Paul Island have been returned to the community. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
In 1868, just a year after the purchase of Alaska, the revenue cutter Wyanda visited the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands. The trip was a reconnaissance mission to find out what kind of riches the territories held.
So there was a doctor that was on board, Dr. Thomas Miner.
That's Aquilina Lestenkoff, the cultural program coordinator for St. Paul's tribal government.
And I believe that the Smithsonian did interact with him prior to this trip. If you find anything of significance, then bring it back.
Among the things Miner brought back were two skulls, a man and a woman. A handwritten tag accompanying them indicated they were from St. Paul Island, which Lestenkoff had a hard time believing at first.
I never ever thought that anyone would take any human remains from the Pribilof Islands.
That's because the Pribilofs weren't settled until the late 1700s, and by that point in time, most Unangan people had converted to Russian Orthodoxy.
And so by then, people were buried in the cemeteries.
Lestenkoff didn't think someone would have dug the skulls up from the village cemetery, so she started looking at old maps of the island for other possible burial sites. She found reports that an abandoned village site called Polovina had a cemetery, so Lestenkoff set off to find it.
I just was walking large pieces of land, and there's like, gosh, if I can just like see a bone sticking out. And then you think, it seems really weird to wish that you could see a human bone sticking out of the ground, but you know, something to give me some sign.
Lestenkoff says she was thinking that maybe, just maybe, if she could find the cemetery, she could reunite the skulls with the bodies. But she didn't find anything.
I don't know that we'll ever solve that mystery.
Lestenkoff says, while it's frustrating that these people may never be reunited with their bodies, she's not angry with Dr. Miner and those who may have helped him.
I don't spend my time feeling anything about those people. I think at this point, it's how are we going to feel about being the ones that put them back to rest? And I think that's where we need to focus our efforts.
So Lestenkoff is turning her attention to the upcoming tribal council meeting, where community members will have a chance to give their input on where the remains should be buried. She thinks the skulls will probably be given a Russian Orthodox burial in keeping with the dominant religious tradition in St. Paul, but she's leaving the options open.
If you're talking bits and pieces over a year, it's definitely going to be very different when you have them here in front of you and you have to make that decision. So we'll see what happens.
No matter what the community decides, Lestenkoff says it would be better than sitting on a dusty shelf in the Smithsonian.
It's a story that definitely shows where we were at 100 plus years ago and where we are now.
The St. Paul repatriation is just the beginning. The Smithsonian is planning to return dozens of human remains to communities across the Aleutians over the next few years. Reporting in St. Paul, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a group of Juneau friends set out on a human-powered trip to the tip of South America.
Just kind of the longest line you could possibly draw on the map from Juneau, you know, so there's always something that intrigued us, so we're going to go for it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaskans for Fair Redistricting released a statement last week calling the redistricting board's amended proclamation plan terrible. Vince Beltrami is the co-chair of AFFR. He says the latest plan could result in the loss of a protected seat in proposed District 38, which pairs urban communities in Fairbanks with rural communities as far out as the Bering Sea coast.
So basically, you'd be disenfranchising the native voting population out in that district and removing the protections that were actually created by the Voting Rights Act.
Beltrami says if the district loses its benchmark seat, the Voting Rights Act will no longer apply in that district, and the change would be permanent. Taylor Bickford is the executive director of the Alaska Redistricting Board. He says AFFR has no reason for concern.
We aren't losing a benchmark seat. The plan that the board has drawn protects the same number of Alaska Native districts that exist in the current plan. We tried to make minimal changes, and any claim that we have less districts in this plan than exist in the benchmark is just erroneous.
With the June 1st filing deadline over, Beltrami says he's also concerned about the timeline.
If that map doesn't clear justice, if they were to take the full 60 days, we're talking about, you know, the end of July, and then the election is only, you know, 3 or 4 weeks after that for the primary. They could possibly still, you know, say sorry that, you know, we're going to have to do a do-over, and the filing deadline that we had doesn't count, and they'd have to potentially delay the primary, which has been done.
The Redistricting Board's current plan is still awaiting approval from the Department of Justice. The board sent their most recent plan to the department on May 25th. DOJ has 60 days to consider it. The Division of Elections on Friday saw a large rush of candidates filing paperwork to get themselves on the statewide ballot for this year's elections. APRN's Dave Donaldson has more.
Most of the uncontested races from last week had disappeared by Friday's filing deadline, as 149 candidates decided to put their names on the ballot for the party primary elections in August and the general elections in November. As the doors were locked at the elections offices, only one senator, Bethel Democrat Lyman Hoffman, was guaranteed of no opposition. In the House, 5 Republicans and 2 Democrats have drawn no opposition. Neither Juneau Representative Republican Kathy Munoz nor Democrat Beth Curtula are challenged this year. The same is the case for Bethel Democrat Bob Herron and Republican Speaker Mike Chenault of Nikiski and 3 other members of his caucus, Alan Osterman of Kodiak, Steve Thompson of Fairbanks, and Mike Hawker of Anchorage. Redistricting has caught several incumbents having to run against other current office holders. Democrat Bob Miller and Republican Tammy Wilson will face off in November for one seat in Fairbanks, as will David Guttenberg and Alan Dick. Democrat Pete Peterson and Republican Lance Pruitt will contend for the same Anchorage seat. That's also the case in the Senate, too, as Republican John Coghill and Democrat Joe Thomas run against each other in Fairbanks, and Bert Stedman and Albert Kukesh face each other in Southeast. 8 former legislators want to return to the Capitol as members. Former Republican Senators Pete Kelly and Ralph Seekins, both of Fairbanks, as well as former Republican Representatives Gabrielle Ledoux, Bob Roses, Kelly Wolf, and Carl Morgan, and Democrats Harry Crawford and Woody Salmon. They'll also all be on the ballots. The primary election is set for August 28th, the general election November 6th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Limited access to health care in Bush, Alaska makes giving birth a bit more complicated for rural pregnant women than for expectant mothers in urban areas like Anchorage or Nome. Women from villages are required to spend the last month of their pregnancies in nearby towns with full-service hospitals. As part of an ongoing series examining efforts to promote cultural understanding and respect between urban and rural Alaskans, APRN contributor Ann Hillman learned how this rule affects families from Pilot Station, a village near Bethel.
Karen Green sits in her small wooden home in Pilot Station, a village of 570 people on the Yukon River. Her 7-month-old baby boy plays in her lap while her husband watches the Lakers game on the TV behind her. Green spent the last month of her pregnancy at the pre-maternal home in Bethel. Before she left, she prepped her husband and her 3 oldest children for their time alone with her 1-year-old daughter.
I'd tell my husband and my children certain things on how to take care of Kennedy, which was my 1-year-old baby at the time, because I was very worried about her. I would show them how to bathe her and feed her and even talk to her.
Women aren't allowed to give birth in the village because the clinic can't provide the necessary medical services in case of complications. And when the mothers go away, the fathers have to get involved. Karen's brother-in-law, James Green Jr., says that when his wife left, it gave him a new perspective on parenting.
And I get to know the kids more and then figure out how it feels to see how what the mother goes through when the father is out there somewhere doing something, always trying to provide for the family.
When Karen Green went to Bethel, she was homesick and worried that her one-year-old girl would forget her. She was uncomfortable at first, sharing a room with two other women at the prematernal home.
But after I got to know the women that I was rooming with and getting comfortable with them, it got so like they were my family already, like they were my sisters.
Like a true older sister, she shared stories of her previous labors, teasing the first-time mothers. She had plenty of opportunities to talk to other women while staying in the pale pink ramshackle building. Doreen O'Brien, the director of the prematernal home, leads a tour of the 30-year-old building in Bethel.
And the poor thing, it's held together with Band-Aids, duct tape, and love, but it's still hanging on there. So,
O'Brien says the idea of the home was first conceived in the late 1960s.
A lady was found living under an overturned boat at the old Indian Health Service Hospital. And when asked why she was living there, she told them that she was told to be in Bethel and wait for her baby to be born, but she didn't have any place to stay. So that's where she was camping, literally camping underneath this boat. And it went, duh, if we're going to have them brought in, we better have a place for them to stay.
The current prematernal home was built in 1971 and serves women from 58 villages around the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. It has bed space for 24 women at a time. In addition to a place to stay, the women are given 3 meals and 2 snacks per day and have space to watch TV, play games, and do crafts. They also attend classes on a variety of topics like proper breathing, quilting, and balancing a checkbook.
You know, you don't want to be bored and idle here because homesick that far away from home for that long is pretty tough.
Though the home is not a medical facility and doesn't offer medical services, some women have given birth there.
We had one little gal go into the bathroom one day and she came out and she screamed or something. And she says, I had my baby. And sure enough, in the toilet, there was a little baby girl. And I was called in from home. And I says, well, you know, that baby was born and baptized at the same time.
Back in Pilot Station, Karen Green says she would have happily given birth to her first few children in the village and avoided being homesick in Bethel. But that's because nothing went wrong. Her last labor was riddled with problems. First, she went into labor a month early, but it was stopped. Then, when she was giving birth, her son was coming out the wrong direction and she was in extreme pain. And the troubles continued.
His cord was wrapped around his leg. So if I lay a certain way, his heart would slow down. So that was very scary.
The baby broke his collarbone and his heart stopped momentarily, but he's healthy now. She says that experience made her thankful to be in Bethel and at the hospital with 5 different doctors, not in Pilot Station at the clinic.
If we were given a chance to have babies here, I wouldn't take it. I'd rather have my future babies in a good, well-equipped hospital.
If Green does end up at the prematernal home again, she should be able to enjoy an updated facility. A new state-of-the-art building is in the works, and construction should start within a year. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
With the statewide salmon fishing season just starting up, many Alaskans are eager to get the highly prized fish for their freezers. But for one Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta fish buyer, there is a clear goal, marketing Kuskokwim River salmon to areas outside Alaska. From KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart has more.
Stuart Curry is the manager of Kuskokwim Seafoods in Bethel. His company just announced a partnership with Orca Bay Seafoods, a large fresh and frozen seafood provider out of Seattle, to market and sell the local salmon that run in the waters of the Kuskokwim River. He says the partnership will allow them to do two things: sell fish directly to Orca to then be distributed to major food store chains like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, and
work with us to develop, using their marketing capabilities, a strong following for Kuskokwim River salmon.
The 5-year contract between the companies, Curry says, will help to differentiate the Kuskokwim salmon from other seafood products in the state.
It's got good meat color and good oil content. Our goal is to go outside of the regional markets in the Pacific Northwest and try to, develop markets in other places, because we hope that that'll bring even greater value.
So conceivably in the future, someone could pick up a Kuskokwim chum filet at, say, a Trader Joe's in Omaha, Nebraska, or a Whole Foods in Madison, Wisconsin. To Curry, the process of getting fish from the Western Alaskan River to tables throughout America is about marketing the product as different than the other types of seafood available to consumers.
To tell the story to consumers so that they know that it's a superior product.
Curry says that it could take up to a year to get a single Kuskokwim salmon from the river to tables. It is unclear how successful the partnership will be, as Kuskokwim salmon does not have the same name recognition as other fish found throughout the state. It is also unclear how exactly Orca plans on selling and marketing the product. Repeated requests for interviews were made to the company, but not returned. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
A group of 20-somethings from Juneau set out on the trip of a lifetime last week. They'll be kayaking through Southeast Alaska and British Columbia, then hopping on bikes and riding through the rest of the Americas. Their final destination is Tierra del Fuego at the southern tip of Argentina. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Yo, good pick! Good picture!
About 100 friends, family, and well-wishers gathered at Sandy Beach in South Douglas on Friday to wish the group good luck on their epic adventure. Organizer Chris Hinckley said the idea behind the trip is to see what the rest of the world has to offer at a leisurely pace.
We don't want to put a time limit on anything. Could be a year, could be 3 years, kind of when the money runs out. But we're going to stop where we want to stop and move how fast we want to move, and no time to be anywhere.
Hinckley, Kanan Bosler, Andrew Francis, Colin Flynn, and Max Stanley plan to do the entire trip. About a dozen friends will join for different legs of the journey, most of them recent college graduates, all under the age of 25. Hinckley says they chose Tierra del Fuego as a stopping point, partly because it seemed like as far as they could go without needing to hop in a car or on a plane.
Just kind of the longest line you could possibly draw on the map from Juneau, so it was always something intrigued us, like, wow, everything connects, man. You can go all the way through there and make it all the way, so we're going to go for it.
They'll be shooting video of the people and places they encounter along the way. Bosler hopes to make a documentary about the trip when they get back.
When we find unique communities that we feel really represent elements of sustainability or happiness or just like unique characteristics that really are like contributing well to living a good life in connection with your surroundings, we want to document that and try to share it with everyone.
Bosler says they don't have a budget, but some expenses have already been covered through fundraisers and gear donations. That includes a Kickstarter campaign that raised more than $5,000 for video equipment, and their kayaks, which are on loan from Seaward Kayaks of British Columbia.
We had a lot of support from local businesses that really changed the game for us and allowed us to really turn this thing into from a vision or a dream into a real reality that's actually happening.
They're also getting plenty of support from their families. Bosler's dad, Carl, says he did a similar trip when he was 19. hitchhiking and hopping freight trains to Alaska. With advances in communications since then, the elder Bosler says he's more excited than nervous for his son.
You know, when I came up here, I'd call my folks maybe once a month from a payphone, and it'd be a collect call, and, you know, they had no idea where I was. And today's technology, you know, you get an email, and it's got the GPS coordinates, and you do the Google Map, and you can put the satellite portion on, and you can almost see where they're getting their fresh water from, you know, where the streams are coming down. So
Hinckley says they'd all eventually like to return to Juneau, but for now, they're just going to enjoy the journey.
I always envision myself coming back here and raising kids, but who knows? There's an adventure ahead of us, so we'll see where it takes us.
As they set out in their kayaks Friday afternoon with the wind at their backs, the group raised their paddles in the air and saluted their friends and family, cheering from shore. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
4 years ago, Rat Island's namesake rodents were eradicated. Now the name is on its way out as well. Earlier this month, the U.S. Board on Geographic Names officially dubbed the remote Aleutian Island Hawatha, an Unungan word meaning entry or welcome. That was the island's traditional name before a Japanese shipwreck in 1780 unleashed a plague of rodents.
People from Atka had used Hawatha in reference to that island even as late as the 1950s.
Karen Plenikoff requested the name change on behalf of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association and the Aleut Corporation. She says response to the proposal was overwhelmingly enthusiastic.
I think the revitalization of the Aleut culture comes in many forms. And this renaming Rat Island to Hawatha is just one more step in that process of cultural revitalization and of being more accurate now that there are no rats on Rat Island.
An eradication campaign led by the federal government and environmental groups wiped out the rodents in 2008. Today, native seabirds are recolonizing the uninhabited island's rocky cliffs. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ann Hillman in Pilot Station, Mark Earhart in Bethel, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The grocery store meltdown. We've all seen it. Harried and frustrated mom, tired toddler in full tantrum mode, and out of nowhere comes a young stock clerk. Drops to his knees next to the screaming child and starts rolling cans and making funny noises. The diversion works. Distracted from his tantrum, the toddler stops crying. Mom takes control and finishes her shopping. Families are stronger when others take an interest. This message sponsored by Best Beginnings, Alaska's Children's Trust, and Strengthening Families Alaska.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.